Okay, so welcome everyone. I'm Bhante Sujata, and we are here to practice some Dharma, do some meditation. Would you like to do some meditation? And anything else you'd like to do? No? What else is there to do? Exactly. So here to do some meditation, some chanting, some Dharma talk, maybe have a few questions. Begin by paying respects to the Bharamadigal people of the Darug Nation upon whose land we sit. Just think for a moment about how awesome that is, that we're honoured to be able to be here. And while the circumstances of the arrival of white people like myself was not necessarily ideal, but we are here now. And so our aim is to be able to live together and to learn from each other. And we have that incredible opportunity to be able to learn from the wisdom of Indigenous people. So let us begin by chanting some words in honour of the Triple Gem.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami, dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami, tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho. Vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhirthiko akaliko ehi pasiko panayiko pachatam veditam vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Iyaridam chattari purisa yugani attha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjalin karaniyo anuttaram punya khetam lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All right, very good. Fine baritone coming in there, that was excellent.
I know,
that was awesome.
That's excellent. Okay, very good. So we're going to do some meditation. Maybe David, as our special guest here tonight, do you want to suggest a meditation for us? No?
Not particularly.
You don't want it? Not particularly? You sure?
It's up to you.
Up to me. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you. That's very kind. Let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. All right, so I'll say a few words about meditation and then we can proceed or stop proceeding, as the case may be. Okay, so got someone coming in? Just got a couple of just-in-timers coming in. So someone's just on their way in, but maybe taking just getting ready. So that's fine. I think they're right now on the way. No worries. Come. Just doing up the man bun. I know the struggles of getting your hair ready before coming. Anyway, fine, okay. So, okay, so I just want to begin our talk about meditation today, but I want to begin the discussion with a small little thought experiment, okay? Imagine that we lived in a world where every time that you did this, time stopped for 1 minute. Okay, so when I did that just now, time just stopped for 1 minute. And I'm going to do it again. And then time stopped for another minute. My question is, how would you know? Sorry? Time stopped, right? But all the clocks are part of that, so the clocks have all stopped. Everything's frozen, yeah.
So
yeah.
So do you see that everything's frozen?
No, why could you? Because your brain stopped. Your consciousness has stopped and the consciousness of everybody else has stopped. How would you know? You can't know. Would you know afterwards? How would you know afterwards? You would know something? Are you sure? I mean, how do we know that world is not this world? Maybe that's the case. Maybe every time somebody does that, we lose 1 minute. You don't lose it, you kind of gain it. Well, you kind of lose it also. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, you could live almost forever, but you wouldn't know it.
Or you can just click every, half a
minute. Does it stop
in
all dimensions?
It stops, yes, all dimensions everywhere, multiverses, everything like that. Yeah.
It's a lacuna,
yes. So maybe that world is this world, and we just don't know it. I mean, it would be a bit complex. You go?
When you had a perception of permanence, because this world's always changing.
Right. You might have a feeling, but you might not. But you might not. Yeah. But the point about this is that from point of our experience, time is subjective. And when we meditate, we change our minds. And in changing our minds, we change time. I mean, you can say we change the perception of time, but the perception of time is actually all we have, ultimately. And this is something, even among physicists, this is sort of a contentious issue. It's like, does time actually exist and what does it mean and so on. But the main point that I'm making here is that when we meditate, we think that we're meditating on the breathing or we're meditating on metta or something like that. But what we're actually doing underneath it, a lot of what we're doing is playing around with time. This hooks into the Buddhist idea of impermanence, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, everything's impermanent, right? We know that. Everything is changing. The Buddha said that if everything's impermanent, then we should let go of it and then we will be free from suffering. But typically, that's not what actually happens, is it? We're like, everything's impermanent. We're like, yeah, okay, everything's impermanent, but we still get attached to things. So obviously, we're not either the Buddha's wrong, A, which would be disappointing, or B, there's something happening at a more subtle level, a deeper level, right? That's not as easy for us to get. So when we begin to meditate, our mind starts to mess with our perception of time. And look, I'm sure you all know what that's like. I'm sure you've all sat there to meditate and then you're sitting there thinking, oh yeah, the 20 minutes must be up by now, and then you sort of quick peek at the clock and you're like, oh god, it's only 5 minutes. And that happens. That's one change in perception. But there's also other changes in perception that are more subtle, like if you've been on a retreat, and I don't, this is not so obvious, but if you're on a retreat, somehow it seems as if like the days just skip by like stones on a pond. You begin the retreat and like the minutes take an hour, but the days only take a couple of minutes. Right? So why is that? So this is not something that's just trivial or something you can just mark up to just perception, because that's what we're doing. We're developing our perception. We're developing how our mind sees. What's happening is that your mind is changing. And as your mind is changing, the way it perceives time is also changing. On the simplest possible level, we could say that we mark out time internally by the things that happen. And when there are fewer things happening, then our perception of time will change. Yeah. So as we meditate, the changes in our consciousness.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you for that very kind reminder of impermanence. That was very good. We've learned the lesson now. And anybody else has another lesson in store for us? Maybe another time. Anyway, so when we're meditating, we are smoothing out the changes in consciousness, right? And we perceive that initially in meditation, in breath meditation in particular, that our breath becomes slower, becomes more smooth, becomes more gentle, right? The change that's happening in there is becoming less. But that's what we're perceiving externally. Internally, that perception is also changing. It's smoothing out. It's becoming nicer, becoming less kind of jagged, right? Less you're not so much being like hauled around corners and pulled this way and that, but more sort of going down a nice smooth stream. And so this change in our perception is inherently linked to the property of mindfulness. Okay, so mindfulness or sati is the continuity of awareness. So mindfulness remembers to keep on being aware. Mindfulness doesn't just know the breath, right? So we think sort of awareness, we can breathe, we're aware of the breath, that's awareness. Mindfulness is the property that knits one breath to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. It keeps on being aware. And when it keeps on being aware, in some senses, it's starting to kind of dissolve the difference between past, present, and future. Yeah? Kind of like sati also means memory, and memory kind of works in the same way, doesn't it? Like the thing that was past becomes present, and sometimes in a very real way. You think of something, you know, something really embarrassing that happened to you in the past, and when you think of that, you're like, oh, and you immediately feel that emotion again, like you're transported back into that moment. It might be when you're at school, and suddenly you just feel. Wave that's shaped like a bell curve, right? And when you have like a, and I don't think time is a moment. So I disagree with most Buddhist philosophers on this particular point. Most people think that time is like a moment, and you've got like slices of it, like on a film, when you have like a procedure like that. I think time's more like a wave that moves on an ocean, and because it's a bell curve, it's not like it's probabilistic. Like you're not, like the present moment isn't just here. The present moment is kind of like a bit of a smear into the past and the future. Like you're kind of balanced between, you've got a little bit of wiggle room there. Yeah? Whereas when you meditate, that bell curve becomes flatter, becomes smoother. And so your mind actually starts to spread out more into the past and the future. And this is one reason why, for example, when you're meditating, especially if you go deeper into meditation, you'll find that memories will come from the past that will be very clear, maybe something you haven't thought of for years, something that you've been wanting to remember or something like that, and will come to you so very clearly. This is what it means when we're talking about citta bhavana, about development of the mind. That we're starting to open up and allow that a greater degree of access to the possibilities of our mind, rather than being just constrained here in this very kind of narrow kind of present. We're starting to create a kind of broader present that has more continuity with the past and the future. Ultimately, will disappear altogether. And so when you go into deep meditation, then the mind, the changes in the mind cease, or at least they're suspended. And so your mind actually stays the same for a long period of time. And in that time, impermanence is suspended. I mean, the state itself obviously is still impermanent, right? But within that state, you don't perceive it as impermanent. You perceive it as just stasis. It's like time has just stopped. And so this, when we're practicing this, this is giving us a chance to be able to actually see the thing that we couldn't see with my previous thought experiment. You see? So if I go like that, you don't know, because you can't see that process. It's just one or the other. But through meditation, because we're going through these different levels, we can begin to understand how your mind is creating and shaping our own perception of time. Now, so let's do some meditation and let's see if we can make time stop. So they're sitting quietly. Gradually let your mind settle into your body. Let your senses be open. Just let anything pass through you, any sounds or feelings. Let them just go through you like the wind. And letting breath very gently come to you, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Evenly, steadily. Letting that soft, gentle energy of the breath enter into each part of your body, each muscle, each cell, calming you down, bringing that soothing energy. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out.
And as you keep going, you begin to notice that each breath has a lot of detail to it. The path that the breath takes, the feeling of it, the roughness or smoothness, the shape of it, the light of it, the energy of it. It changes each time. Each breath, quite unique. And as the breath slows and stills, notice how the mind becomes content to repose without moving, without wanting, stretching out, relaxing in the present. Enjoying that peace. Enjoying that tranquility. So now we're coming near to the end of the meditation. Let your mind come back into your senses, come back to normal. Hear the sounds around you, feel the touch of cloth on your skin, and just come back up. Now, before we finish, take a minute to review the meditation. Look back, and particularly this time, look at it through the lens that we've been talking about, the lens of time. How did your perception of time change? Did you feel that sense of continuity with one breath with the next? Did you notice any gaps in the thoughts or in the movements of the mind? Was there a time when your mind was steady and still? Why was it steady and still? Was it steady and still because you held it down there and wouldn't let it move? Or was it steady and still because it was peaceful and happy? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, everyone, let's take a break for a few minutes, grab a cup of tea, and come back for some Dhamma talk. Okay, so welcome back, everybody, and welcome back to all of our folks online. So just a quick announcement, a little announcement et. So next Wednesday, as many of you will know, we do a meditation at the Crow's Nest Center. That's in Ernest Street in Crow's Nest every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Now, normally that's always a in-person event. So for anybody in Sydney, especially for folks in Sydney who live in the eastern suburbs, then that's a good place to come there. But this Wednesday we're having a slightly special event. I was invited a couple of weeks ago to participate in an interfaith discussion of the Pope's message on climate change. Okay, so the Pope has just released his second encyclical on climate change. It's one called Laudato Deum, and this was done in order to coincide with the COP28 meeting on climate change, which has just started in the Emirates. Yeah,
Now, everyone thinks this is going to be go great because it's being run by literally the CEO of the Emirates oil company. So this goes, this is going to be going great. And so the Pope put out a message on it. And usually these papal encyclicals are actually I'm not sort of in the habit of reading them often. But the ones on climate change that he does are actually pretty good. Like, he does a pretty nice overall summary of things. And most of his emphasis is really about focusing on the human impact and human response of climate change and looking at it from a kind of a moral and a values point of view. So it's actually a really nice little read. And so we're having a discussion, an interfaith discussion on climate change, organized by some of the people involved in the interfaith climate change movement. It happened to be on Wednesday at 7 o'clock, and so I said, well, why don't we do it at, I'll participate at Crow's Nest. And then they said, so it turns out we're actually hosting the whole event at Crow's Nest now. So that's kind of happened, and that's just like happened over the last few days. It's still happening, really. We're sort of figuring out how to do it. But so if you could come along next Wednesday, so that will be from 7 till 8. And so it'll be basically, there's a webinar from 7 till 8. And so anybody can come along to Crow's Nest or participate in the webinar. I'll put the link for the webinar on the website. And afterwards we'll have a discussion about it and so on. So that'll be next Wednesday, 7 p.m. Just sort of let everybody know that. And by that time, because the COP28's just started a couple of days ago, I think it started yesterday or something, so by Wednesday we should have a reasonable idea how these things go. Although, to be honest, not really. Usually these things are organized the same way that I used to study for my exams. You know, you basically waffle around for the whole time and then do it all on the night before. And that's how actually the fate of our planet is decided. that should be really interesting. I'm really looking forward to engaging on this because it often is a way of being able to see things from different perspectives, and I'm really interested to listen to what the different perspectives that are brought to it, because there'll be some people there who are very experienced and have a lot of knowledge and insight and hopefully wisdom in this area as well. All right. So, Ayasela has offered the opinion that, just on what we point I made before about stopping time with a finger snap, is that if things freeze or stop and then restart again after a minute, you would know it when things restart. You'd know the absence and the experience of the start of the five senses, will, perception, consciousness, and whatever is subject to the freeze. Yes and no. Like, yes, in the real world, okay? Because the start of senses is something that itself takes time, right? Senses don't operate instantaneously. They actually take time to ramp up and time to become aware, and short amount of time, but time nonetheless. But in the hypothetical magic scenario that I was proposing, then they would just be not there, and then they would be there. So I'm not sure that that would apply in that kind of scenario. Anyway, so sorry?
The studies on precognition are amazing.
Studies on precognition. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, exactly. It seems empirically undeniable. We feel into the future, and
okay,
they can sense the decisions we're going to make. And equally, it seems that moments leave the hands of a bowler as a spin ball. That the past puts a spin on the present, knowing and feeling into the future. So I think the smudge theory is really a clever way of putting it. And I think maybe the interruption could be sensed within the as a break in the smudge.
Okay, so yeah, a few ideas there. So whether the smudge, I'll leave that one aside. But the precognition you mentioned about the fact, like, one of the implications, if that's true, hypothetically, that there is a kind of smear of time that... Sorry, everybody. I had no audio online. Oh, my God, that was such a fascinating conversation. You just... I don't think we can't recapture that, but... I'm sorry. Okay. But I was going to ask, like, what studies were you referring to when you were talking about precognition?
There's ones where you sort of pick black or red.
Okay.
And it seems to be that we know you can sense from the brainwave happening that there's a knowing of which one will be picked before it's picked.
Right.
And when it's talking split multiple.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're not saying precognitive.
Right.
Right. Precognitive to the millisecond.
Right.
Which means that there's some sort of existence or interface with the future.
Yeah.
I'm not explaining it as well as it could, but the end supposition from these studies is that the only solution is that there must be some pegging into the future that's controlling the now.
Right. So just the reference was about some studies that's showing like choices and so on, that you could choose, say, red and black and different colours, and that there's an ability to sort of know about that in a way before the choice is sort of made or is made conscious. So, but the only thing I'd say about that is I don't think that necessarily means that you're hooking into the future per se, but what the Smith's theory, for lack of a better word, perhaps the bell curve theory might be a nicer one, would say that our understanding of what the present is a bit looser than that. It's not that it's actually kind of the future. It's that actually the present is a bit more loosely defined and a bit more spread out. The future is kind of wobbly. Sorry, the present's kind of wobbly. Anyway, that's the kind of basic idea.
Would that be because like consciousness is being held in the present? Sorry, by sankhara?
Not even that. It's even more complex than that. It's because consciousness itself is a construct of many different kinds of things. And so because of that, it's an interaction of all of these different kinds of forces that give rise to what we call a consciousness, a bit like, again, like a wave. There's so many different atoms and molecules or particles or whatever that's making up a wave in the water. So just by its very nature, it's inherently complex. This is saying, I mean, we know that from, say, how the brain works. Like if I, stimulate my fingertip, it takes time for that to actually register consciously because physically can't go faster than the speed of light. So that's like a physical parallel. So I'm just suggesting that mentally it's kind of a similar thing. Your mind is a complex system. And it takes time for that system. Yeah? And that system is what generates time. So the idea that present is like a slice is just an abstraction, just kind of an idea.
I love that on the 4th of July, 1776, King George wrote in his diary, "Nothing happened today."
Excellent. That's the diary entry that all monastics aspire to. All right. So we should probably do a bit more of a kind of a serious Dhamma talk here. Sorry, folks online, for missing out on doing that. But I'll kind of expand these kinds of ideas now that I'm talking about. I'm talking about time. I'll talk about time and impermanence. And the meaning of that in terms of Dhamma. Now, we talk a lot about impermanence in Buddhism, especially in Theravada Buddhism. And it's a fundamental principle in all forms of Buddhism, but in Theravada Buddhism especially emphasized. And the idea of impermanence, on the face of it, seems like a fairly banal thing. Right? Everything changes, okay? Everybody, we all know that, everything changes. And yet, so much of religious or spiritual life is a search for something that does not change. Right, and we're looking for God, or we're looking for heaven, or we're looking for something that's going to last. And it's almost like we feel tested or persecuted to be in the present and be harassed by the fact that things change, you know? And one of my favorite songs growing up was a Lou Reed song, One Perfect Day. Beautiful song, One Perfect Day. How long does a perfect day last? Just 24 hours. And then it's gone. And that's the nature of our life, that you can, even if you can achieve something perfect, that's it. So quickly it's gone. When I was a young monk, I went with my friend Venerable Chandako, and his mum was visiting Thailand, and we went, travelled around a bit and so on, and his mum took us to somewhere. We were in Chiang Mai, and we stopped by this place, and we had an ice cream sundae in the morning time. And that's like really special if you're a young monk in Thailand, and to have an ice cream sundae, it's like, wow, that's really a treat. And we finished it. Chandako just looks at me and says, like, I knew it was impermanent, but did it have to be that impermanent? And so it's relentless, isn't it? It's just relentless. As soon as you've got something that you think is good, it starts to get bad, like right away. It just starts to get bad. I mean, if you're a beautiful restaurant and they serve you the most delicious meal, I mean, as soon as it's in front of you, it starts to get worse. I mean, it starts to get to cool down, to get worse, and then you cut into it and you take a bite of it, and then it's gone. I mean, it's just so quick. And, you know, you look at sort of human activity, you know, like what were you trying to do? People try to establish dynasties, you know, you try to build houses or establish empires or do something so that your name will last, or that your lineage will last, or something will last. Because otherwise everything disappears. You look at all of the people in the world, billions upon billions of people who've born, had full, rich lives, they've died, they're just gone. And a lot in traditional cultures, people often would like preserve the names of ancestors and lineages and things like that. And we find this even in ancient Indian scriptures, even before Buddhism, you find these long lineage lists and so on to try to keep these names alive, you know. I don't know the names of my ancestors. I mean, I know my grandparents. I don't even know all my grandparents' names, to be honest. My dad's father, I never knew him, never met him before that. Nothing. Just gone. And so everything in our life is so ephemeral, and so much that when people approach religious life, they want to find something permanent. And my belief is that a lot of that basic drive, I don't mean the theology of it or anything. I mean the basic ideas, I think a lot of it comes from looking up at the stars. I think this is like fundamental to our perception of this world. You know, you're a pastoral herder, right? Or a tribesman or a hunter-gatherer, right? You live mostly outdoors, wandering from place to place, yeah? A hard life, yeah? A hard life. There's snakes on the ground. The ground is hard. There's not a Starbucks to be seen. And threats and dangers, food, everything is hard to get. Right? And then at night time, you look up and there's these brilliant blazing lights in the sky. They just stay there. And everything down here is changing all the time. You don't know if it's going to rain or shine, or there's going to be a fire or a flood, or so many things here are so just changing all the time. But up there, just these brilliant beings of light that just shine down forever in this orderly, beautiful pattern. And I think it's not coincidental that we live in a time where we have forgotten our connection with, I don't know, divinity or something about the sacred. No matter, I'm not talking in terms of like what your belief system is. I'm talking about a sense. And we're living in cities where we can't see the stars anymore. Yeah, I mean, in Sydney, we're pretty lucky. It's one of the few large cities in the world where you can actually still see, you have reasonably clear air, you can still see the stars. So many places in the world, they're just gone. And you can be born, live your whole life and die and never see the stars. And so there they are, shining, bright, eternal. I mean, who wouldn't want to go there, right? Looks great. And so a lot, I think, of our imagination about what we call the divine or the eternal or something like that is about the stars. Of course, we know from modern physics, we know that they're not actually eternal. They last for a long time, but not forever. And they don't really stay the same. In fact, stars are actually like super impermanent. Like if you're actually standing on the surface of a star, it would be you would have a highly impermanent state of being, right? And they are actually cauldrons of nuclear furnaces that are just constantly in a state of upheaval and change, but only from a distance do we see that they look permanent. And even, you know, their life doesn't last, right? So stars will die, they will explode or something like that. You know, that when I introduced that thing of the clicking the fingers and then imagining we might live in a world where we're having gaps in time, I was trying to sort of introduce this kind of abyss of existential anxiety into the talk. And another good one to think about in that regard is the fact that the light from the sun takes, I think it's 6 minutes. Is it 6 minutes to reach the Earth? 8 minutes, is it? 8 minutes, thanks. So 8 minutes. So the sun could have actually exploded 8 minutes ago. And we wouldn't know it. If you want to put a timer on, wait for another 8 minutes and then just kind of see. Right? So, again, this idea that the present isn't the present. I mean, if the sun did explode, then is that in our present or not? Because, anyway. So my point being here is that we long for this freedom of something that's permanent. And we kind of have this idea that, again, I'm sort of thinking back into like the way that these things are sort of constructed and the bedrocks of how people think about it. I think we think in very kind of like you can make things that will stabilize time. For example, a building. Right, classic example, right? You can make a building and that's going to control the weather, it's going to control the rain, the heat, all those kinds of things, and it's going to be relatively permanent. Yeah? And the lastingness of peoples, dynasties, kings and so on was very much associated with their building of cities and building of places that would have that permanence. And so we have this kind of idea that we can create a permanence through the things that we do. And of course, this is still very much a driving belief in a lot of our benevolent overlords, by which I mean Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos and the like, who, you know, Peter Thiel was renowned for or had a reputation for like drinking the blood of the young so he could live forever. It's not confirmed whether he's actually, sorry? Who's Peter Thiel? He was one of the original investors. He's one of what they call the South African mafia. He's, along with Elon Musk and others, was one of the original founders of PayPal and one of the most influential investors in Silicon Valley, in Facebook and so on and so forth. Yeah, he's one of the guys who bought a huge estate in New Zealand so he could go there and live out the end of the world on his estate. I mean, like getting young people and like siphoning off their blood and drinking it. Unconfirmed, let us say unconfirmed. But if you know Peter Thiel's character, it doesn't seem too implausible. But anyway, moving along. But these guys certainly want to live forever. That's no doubt about that. Whether it's going to be by freezing yourself and being revived in the future, or by uploading yourself into a computer or something like that, or whatever you're going to do, or establishing a galactic empire, right, that's going to last forever, that those dreams have a scope to them and a power that is difficult for us mere mortals to comprehend. And this is why I think we often miss it. Like, we often don't see that. Like, people who are sensible, who are not, you know, narcissists or not all of whatever they are, but who are not like that, we come to terms with our mortality. And we think this is normal, that this is just what you do, right? Of course, everybody would like to live for longer. But probably I'm going to go out on a limb and say that nobody here really spends much time thinking about how they can make themselves live forever. I mean, you might want to do a bit of exercise or, you know, do something that's going to, you know, but it's not like an overriding concern, because I think most people, you come to an acceptance of that at a certain level, right? But that desire is still there, right? It's still underlying so much of what we do. We still kind of subconsciously act as if we're going to live forever. Yeah, and that's how we let the moment pass us by. Right, we put things off instead of doing them. Especially when it comes to practice, when it comes to meditation, we can always do it tomorrow. Yeah, that's why the Buddha was always reminding us, maybe tomorrow you're not going to be here.
Yeah. Sorry,
just yes.
Another question.
Please, yeah.
In terms of that desire for that permanence,
yeah.
Do you have anything like to go back to like nature nurture? Like, is that learned? Is that, have you read any studies or in your knowledge like the nature nurture side of it?
Okay, so good question about how that desire for permanence and that desire to live forever comes from. I think that it's kind of ultimately rooted in the desire to live. Right? So in Buddhism, we talk about bhava tanha, the craving to live, the craving to exist, the craving to be. Or really, what it means is the craving to continue, right? To keep the craving to keep going. And you know, that's one of the kind of fundamental desires, I think, that any creature. I mean, just from an evolutionary point of view. Probably the fundamental desire, right? The desire to be and to keep being. And so I think that it's natural to have that, right? So have that desire is natural. But then when we encounter, and this is what I was saying before about the stars, right? When you look up the stars, you start to contemplate it, right? You begin to realize, you know, there's something else. There's this world up there, which is not like this world down here. Here everything is impermanent. There everything is permanent. Yeah? And I think this is where that idea starts to suggest itself, that we can start to think about that and say, oh, I wonder if we could be like that. Yeah? That's where I think it comes from, ultimately. Yeah. And it's very seductive, right? Yeah. To be able to think that you would live forever. I mean, I've said this many times before, but, you know, I think that the reality of people living forever would be horrible, like unbelievably horrible. Number one is the people who live forever would be all of the very worst people, because they can afford it, right? So that's number one. That would be just terrible. And it would be, the world would become so bad because there wouldn't be any young people. All the old people would just keep on being old. And you just like, everyone would just sit around and talk about the music that they listened to when they were young and how that's the best music that was ever made. And like, where does the creativity come from? Where does the churn come from? You know, where does the spark come from? It's where change is what actually brings all of those things into life. So it's part of the thing with impermanence. Like impermanence is a very ambiguous thing because impermanence actually is life and things changing. And we need change and we need stimulus. And this is one of the one of the dangers in spiritual life, because when you approach spiritual life, especially if you want to live in a monastery or something like that, typically people want to live in an environment where nothing changes. I joked about that earlier, said, you know, what happened today, nothing happened. I mean, that's what monastics dream about, living in a place where nothing happens. Unfortunately, something always does happen, right? And you always perceive that something happening is wrong. So it shouldn't happen, right? And we should be able to just live without those things happening. And so one of the traps in spiritual life is that you get over-attached to that idea that nothing's going to happen, and that you can end up getting bored, getting disillusioned, you can end up getting rigid, narrow-minded, all of those kinds of things, which are things that constrict your mind and constrict your awareness because of the lack of stimulus and the lack of change. Yeah? And so Sorry, folks online. Looks like we had a network issue here. Did I? I snapped my fingers. Oh my God. Sorry about that. Okay, so come back to impermanence. So I've been just talking about impermanence from a bunch of different perspectives, from philosophical perspectives and humanist perspectives and so on. But I want to bring it back to a meditation perspective. So when we're talking about meditation, we talk about developing the perception of impermanence. Now, when we talk about it in that way, a lot of the time people think, oh, that means like you're doing some kind of like Vipassana meditation or something like that, where you are noting transient phenomena as they occur. All right, so you sit there, thought comes up, you're aware, oh, this is my thought, the thought ends, you are aware of my thought has ended, and so on. And so you can meditate like that. And apply the same to the feelings in your body and so on. And so this is one approach to meditation and one of the ways of seeing impermanence. Right? But there are many ways of seeing impermanence. In fact, there are as many ways of seeing impermanence as there are ways of seeing, because your seeing is impermanence. So no matter what meditation that you're doing, no matter how you're aware, impermanence will always be a part of it. And so when you're doing, say, meditation on the breath, mindfulness of breathing, which we were doing earlier, we're developing a perception of impermanence, but kind of subtly in the background. We're not really foregrounding it, right? But we are, in a sense, changing the way that our mind works, stretching time out, yeah? And learning to see impermanence from a quite different kind of perspective. Now, we can then take that up as a practice and as a reflection. So we can practice in that way and then reflect on it as impermanence. So when your mind becomes still and peaceful like that, then you can start to reflect on the nature of time and how your mind is changing even in that peacefulness. And you start to reveal more and more subtle layers of impermanence. And so this is one of the things to bear in mind in meditation. You know, the Buddha said, sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. That all conditions includes all kinds of meditation. Doesn't matter what kind of meditation you're doing. It's a conditioned phenomena. You're changing the way your mind works. And so impermanence is always playing a part there. So even if you're not focusing on impermanence 100%, it's still informing the way that you understand the meditation. So my point here is very simply that when we're practicing meditation, don't imagine that the different kinds of meditation are too kind of siloed off from one another. Actually, each kind of meditation, breath meditation or metta meditation, if you're meditating on a mantra, you're meditating on a light, if you're meditating on watching feelings in your body or noting different sensations or scanning your body, all of these kinds of things, All of these are just different ways of working with your awareness and with your mindfulness. And so they will all inform these qualities of impermanence and, of course, other Dhamma qualities as well in their own way. So learning and practicing different kinds of meditation is useful because it will teach you about how impermanence works from these different perspectives. So that's just a few words for today on impermanence. Hopefully that has been entertaining. Hopefully I managed to convey something of a sense of like an existential abyss in which we might fall. It's good to keep an awareness of that because otherwise we get complacent. And any more questions? Yeah. Yeah.
When was it introduced into meditation practice or Buddhist thought? Because I know certainly in some Burmese tradition,
Right. So the question was about when or how the idea of momentariness was introduced into Buddhism. It's a very widespread idea in Buddhism, actually. And you find it in many of the early schools of Buddhism. It's not found in the suttas, and it's not found in the early Abhidhamma either, in the canonical Abhidhamma. People say it's an Abhidhamma idea. I mean, I think you find it kind of mentioned maybe once or twice, but it's not like it's a foundational idea there. But the schools, as the schools of Buddhism sort of started defining themselves. One of the ways they defined themselves was their different interpretations of time. Some said that Theravada, the classical Theravada idea, is that there's mind moments. There's a moment, but each moment has a three sub moments, an anukana, right? Arising, sustaining, and ending. And then they have another group, the Sautrantikas, who said, no, that's too long. There's only two. There's only arising and ceasing. And then there's some others, the Sarvastivadins, they wanted to stretch it out a bit more. They said there's arising, sustaining, changing while persisting, and then ceasing. Yeah? And of course, you can draw all of these ideas from the suttas because the Buddha did indeed talk about time in all of these different kinds of ways. So personally, I think that all of these different Abhidhamma approaches, these are really ways that scholars were trying to clarify the particular problems that were facing them at the time. I think that they were kind of later became overinterpreted as being like a sort of definitive statement on what the nature of time was. But I think that they were really sort of trying to grapple with the questions of like, how do you really get theoretical clarity and consistency in the way that you treat notions like impermanence. And in particular, one issue which they had to confront from the suttas, you see, the Buddha came along in a time when everybody else pretty much was talking about permanence, right? The Brahmins were like, yourself is the same as the cosmos and it'll be eternal. And the Jains were like, you have an eternal soul that will live forever and so on. So most people were talking about permanence. So the Buddha emphasized impermanence. But then, of course, then there's the question, it's not completely impermanent, right? I mean, we're all the same people that we were when we came into the room, in a way, right? I mean, clearly time is not just a pile of dust, right? There's a connection there, right? There's a flow. And so there was a lot of these kinds of discussions, how do you reconcile impermanence with continuity? And so the different ways that was kind of grappled with and so on. Again, the Theravada solution to that one was through conditionality. So the past and the future are connected because of the past causes the future. The past causes the present or the future. So the different ways of conceiving that. So this is something that grew up through the Buddhist traditions in the 200-400 years after the Buddha passed away. Yeah.
More intellectual exercise, philosophical.
I believe so, yeah.
To start with, and maybe later on,
I do, I believe so, yeah. I believe the Abhidhamma tradition was primarily like a theoretical process rather than being informed by meditation per se. I mean, it's difficult to state that with any certainty. But certainly that was like a lot of the perspective of some of the early Mahayana sutras. Okay, so you have some of the early Mahayana sutras would be like, oh, here you go, like all of those Shravakas, all of those early Buddhists are all sitting around in the monastery, endlessly arguing about the khandhas and the ayatanas and dependent origination and impermanence and so on, and none of them know the true flavor of it, which is what we know because we're in the forest meditating, right? And so this is that kind of thing that was going on in that community at that time. So we're now, that time I'm talking now, maybe 400 or 500 years after the Buddha, the early Mahayana sutras. So, you know, there's definitely that feeling of like a kind of a tension between different ways of approaching the Dhamma. Yeah. Anyway. All right. I've got a couple of questions online which I might just briefly answer before we wrap up for today. Ignacio says, is impermanence ultimately about our experience, or does it also include the impermanence of some reality out there? The truth is out there. Do, 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 do. So from a Buddhist point of view, a point of view of conditionality or interrelationship. So the idea of a reality in philosophy or Western philosophy, you tend to have two approaches. One is that reality really exists out there. We call realism, like that's it, that's actually something that exists. Or it's that only things exist in your mind. It's idealism, right? So things only exist in our mind, and out there is just an illusion. Buddha taught dependent origination. Right? He taught interrelationship. What we experience is the interaction between external things and internal things. He wasn't talking about whether these things exist really, truly, woolly, independent of this. He was saying that's what our reality is. Our primary experience is this relationship, is that connection. It's not that these things fundamentally exist and then have to be connected. The connection is the fundamental reality. Sumana asks, Bhante, I don't understand whether samsara is permanent. It seems to be just forever and ever there. So it certainly goes on a bit, doesn't it, right? It just sort of keeps on going on, yeah. Sometimes you're like, you know, so over it. And you're like, but permanent. Of course, it depends on the notion of permanent here. It doesn't. Samsara, of course, is always changing, right? So it's not actually still, right? But does it keep on going in a changing way forever? Hard to say. The Buddha said you can't know the beginning of samsara, and the only way you can really know the ending of it is through getting enlightened. But then you only know the ending of samsara for you. But samsara, does it keep going? Well, you wouldn't know, would you? So, hard to say. I'm guessing that would be one of the questions that the Buddha wouldn't answer. So Charit asks, I was wondering why it's so easy to see that pleasant experiences are impermanent, but much harder to remember that it's the same with unpleasant ones, right? Good point, that we tend to often get caught up, you know, especially strong unpleasant sensations like grief and so on, and it's really hard to see the way past them, yeah. Is it because the mind isn't confident in the impermanence of suffering because there haven't been enough pleasant experiences? Is this the reason why it's important to develop jhanas? Is it because the mind isn't confident in the impermanence of suffering there haven't been enough pleasant experiences? I'm not entirely sure about that, but I think a lot of it is to do with fear. You're triggered with that really negative experience, and then there's this kind of fear that's going to keep going or is going to recur, and so you're going to be trapped there forever. But there's also another sense with unpleasant sensations is that they become pleasant when they become part of who you are, and if you think of yourself in that term, then that becomes something that you hold on to, because you like being sad. You like being depressed. I mean, you don't like it, but at least you're something, right? You know who you are as someone who's depressed. Right? So, you know, think of it, say, if you lose somebody who's close to you, you know, and you feel grief because they're gone and so on. And so you can hold on to that feeling of grief because you don't want to ask yourself the question, who am I now that that person is no longer in my life? And so it can be easier to hold on to that grief than it is to make a new life without that person who you loved. Deepika, yeah. Yeah. Probably, right? So probably evolution plays a part in that. Yeah, so you have a negative, I imagine so. Yeah, negativity bias, keep you safe, right? Yeah. Okay, everyone, we should probably wrap up about now. I'm going to pop, sorry? Yes, I'll announce that in just a second. So I'm just going to pop into the chat the link for our website, in case people don't know. Just as a reminder, next Wednesday at Crow's Nest, so please come along if you're in Sydney, or I will put the webinar address on the website before then if you are around. Sutta Central is celebrating our publication of the Pali Suttas and Vinaya, translated by myself and by Venerable Brahmali, and that will be on Saturday the 9th of December, and time from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Dixon Room in the State Library of New South Wales. So please come along, the State Library, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. So I'll be there, and a bunch of other cool people will be there as well, including Venerable Brahmali, and Jeff Gallup will be there, the very good friend of the Dhamma, the former Premier of WA. He's giving a keynote. Our friend, I think Nadine's doing the panel supervising. Yeah, Nadine Levy from Wollongong, from the Nantian University down there. Another good Dhamma friend is going to be helping to moderate, so hopefully we should have a nice day there. So that's the State Library, Dixon Room on the 9th. Also, we're still Metta Retreat coming up, 10-day retreat, details again on the website. And if anybody wants to book for that, I think we still have some places. Still have some places. Yeah, great venue, a great location to come for a retreat over Christmas. And I'll be back here next week. Impermanence permitting. Yes. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Very good. Thanks, everybody. And see you again. Be happy.